Well, I'm going to give way to our first speaker now, who is Gavin Plumley. You will have biographical details of all of the speakers, but Gavin, whom I met about 3 years ago when we shared a platform at the Freud Museum on that occasion talking about Mahler, is a writer and broadcaster specialising in the music and culture of Central Europe. Gavin has appeared on BBC Radio 3 and has recently spoken at the Royal Opera House, the English National Opera, the City of Birmingham Symphony Orchestra, the V&A and the Freud Museum, and the New Gallery in New York, and he has given a number of talks at the South Bank Centre's programme, The Rest Is Noise Festival, during this year. He was recently appointed commissioning editor for the English language programmes at the Salzburg Festival, and although it's not elaborated here, if you get a chance, I strongly recommend, warmly recommend you look at his website, the details of which are here in the programme. Most interesting, regularly updated, and a source of great information. My pleasure to invite Gavin Plumley now to come and talk about private theatre and hysterical opera, Wagner's influence in Freud's Vienna.
Thank you, Anthony, and thank you to the Freud Museum for inviting me back to give a modified version of a paper I presented at the museum in May. Wagner is nothing if not a divisive figure. Indeed, right from the off, Wagner bisected audience and intellectual response. Nietzsche, at first a vocal adherent, later wondered whether Wagner was a human being at all. Is he not rather a disease? He contaminates everything he touches. He has made music sick. And even within the notably decadent framework of Oscar Wilde's The Picture of Dorian Gray, such sickness is not to be borne. I like Wagner's music better than any other music. It is so loud that one can talk the whole time without people hearing what one says. More damning, though, was the Viennese critic Edward Hanslick's sally that Wagner's characteristics can only be of psychiatric interest. This most hopeless case of self-idolatry has reached such an unimagined height that there is simply no oxygen left for normal brain functions. One can only recall Wagner's Old Testament predecessor, King Nebuchadnezzar, who for so long believed himself to be a god that over time he turned into an ordinary ox eating grass, and eventually found himself turned into an opera by Verdi. Regardless of these direct, decadent, dandifying postures, there can be no doubt that of the colossal impact that Wagner has on music, on culture, and its discourse. As Barry Millington has surmised, the fact that every cultural figure of any standing, from Marx to William Morris and Ruskin to Tolstoy, had an opinion on Wagner and his music is indicative of the composer's influence. And if that particular quartet remained unconvinced of his genius, there were countless others who took a contrary view. Even with Freud, who was largely antipathetic to the opera house, the absence of Wagner from his writing speaks as much as if it had been there. At least, if we dig a little further back, we learn that both Freud and Wagner drew much of their inspiration from the same source, namely Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer's discussion of madness directly prophesies Freud's theories of repression and his first theory of the etiology of neurosis. Free association is also part and parcel of Schopenhauer's view, and he, Freud, and Wagner share many of the same ideas about human sexuality. As Schopenhauer wrote, the sexual impulse is the most vehement of all craving, the desire of desires, the concentration of all our willing. The quotation could come straight from Freud, as if written in response to Wagner's Tristan und Isolde, his most influential work. The impact of the music of Wagner, not least Tristan, on composers of the late 19th century and the early 20th century was equally immense. As Millington goes on one level it can be detected in the rich, harmonic language, unresolved dissonances, sequences, and other technical features of late Romanticism, as exhibited by Elgar, Richard Strauss, and Alban Berg, to name but three. The use of leitmotifs and through-composed procedures in opera also became standard. Ultimately, no composer of the post-Wagnerian period can be said to be untouched by his influence, even if only in a negative sense. It is into the early part of that stream of influence, the immediate post-Wagnerian period, that I am going to pitch us this morning, framing my discussion of post-Wagnerian opera in the first two decades of the 20th century, particularly those by Franz Schricker and Erich Wolfgang Korngold, within a psychological discussion. It may be odd to start a day devoted to Wagner with two composers who emerged after his death, and who, at least on the outside, move far away from the mythological basis of his music dramas. Yet what is so extraordinary about Schricker and Korngold and their operas is they posit a new type of opera in which time, past or present, is itself mythologized by the implicit and sometimes explicit presence of Freud's theories within the drama. For if, as Patrick Carnegie has suggested, myth is not limited by history, then the gritty, modern present of Schricker and Korngold's operas is no less valid a subject for music drama than Lohengrin, the Nibelungenlied, or Tristan and Isolde. Myth, as Carnegie goes on, enshrines timeless truths. Love, hate, and all those subjects that are the stuff of drama were, for Wagner, most powerfully represented in myth. Armed with Freud's investigatory discourse itself, searching and calling on timeless truths, composers were able to embrace Wagner's musical language and uncover hidden psychological veracities. The focus of the psychological aspect of my talk revolves around one particular case, undertaken by Josef Breuer, which became a central chapter within his and Freud's studies on hysteria, the first major polemic of the Freudian literature. The case in question is that relating to Anna O, the famous alias of Berta Pappenheim. Breuer treated her for a severe cough, paralysis of the extremities on the right-hand side of her body, and disturbances of vision, hearing, and speech, as well as hallucination and episodes in which she lost consciousness. Breuer diagnosed Pappenheim with hysteria, and Freud later implied that her illness was a result of the resentment felt over her father's real and physical illness that later led to his death. But rather than a debate around the case itself, I am going to draw one particular idea out of Breuer's findings and apply it to our reading of the post-Wagnerian operatic repertoire. In describing Pappenheim's condition, Breuer struck upon a particularly evocative phrase. "This girl," he writes, "who was bubbling over with intellectual vitality, led an extremely monotonous existence in her puritanically minded family. She embellished her life in a manner which probably influenced her decisively in the direction of her illness, by indulging in systematic daydreaming, which she described as her private theatre." He expands that extraordinary idea, rich with dramatic metaphor, as follows. "The habit of daydreaming, her private theatre, laid the foundations for a dissociation of her mental personality. Nevertheless, a dissociation of this degree is still within the bounds of normality. Reveries and reflections during a more or less mechanical occupation do not in themselves imply a pathological splitting of consciousness, since if they are interrupted, if, for instance, the subject is spoken to, the normal unity of consciousness is restored. Nor, presumably, is any amnesia present. In the case of Anna O, however, this habit prepared the ground upon which the effect of anxiety and dread was able to establish itself, transforming the patient's habitual daydreaming into a hallucinatory absence." If we can, for a moment, disregard the effects of this hallucinatory absence on Pappenheim's well-being and focus on the language with which it is described, a private theatre might sound like a very creative state. Indeed, Breuer describes Pappenheim as having great poetic and imaginative gifts, and goes on to portray the sad but very charming tales that Pappenheim related while in her semi-absent condition. Given the great theatrical traditions of Vienna, a tradition that was made manifest in the colossal heft of the Burgtheater and the Hofoper on the Ringstrasse, it seems fitting that we take the psychological reference to the theatrical back to the theatre itself, and, in this Wagner year, look for instances of private theatre behaviour within the operatic repertoire of the time. The personality that is our starting point this morning positively invites the comparison, for in Wagner, it was Wagner, of course, who made public his ideals of a private theatre. Firstly, through King Ludwig II, who wanted to have a theatre specifically dedicated to Wagnerian performance, a stage for the thoughts of the composer's mind, if you like. And secondly, through Wagner himself, who built the Festspielhaus in Bayreuth. Having constructed that building, he proffered a kind of music drama in which habitual daydreaming and hallucinatory absence became its watchwords. With a seamless flow of music, wrapping us in a sensory envelope from which we cannot, or would not choose to escape, depending who you are, submerging the orchestra in a pit, dimming the lights, creating a magical space where imaginative acts are performed. Bayreuth is the perfect private theatre for such out-of-body experiences. As if to underline further the appositeness of a discussion of that legacy, Wagner's late music dramas often suggest splittings of consciousness and dissociations of mental personalities, not least within Tristan and Isolde, in which Wagner creates a dialectical world of reality versus dream, phenomenal day as opposed to noumenal night, in which the sexual fluxes of its eponymous lovers are echoed in a score that is neither bridled by tonality nor restricted by form. By drinking the love potion, the lovers change their world irrevocably, hiding from reality in their private theatre, just as Pappenheim does, the lovers dissociate from the world. Wagner's wide-ranging idiom, distanced, destabilised, equally offers a musical metaphor for the idea of private theatre. In the final moments of Tristan and Isolde, Isolde asks, "Do I alone hear this melody?" She also references das Unbewusste, Freud's chosen word for the unconscious, based, of course, like Tristan, in Schopenhauer. Paralleled with the appearance of Freud's own work, Gustav Mahler's performances of Tristan at the turn of the last century created significant interdisciplinary echoes in Vienna. One witness to a performance conducted by Mahler on the 8th of May 1906 wrote that powerful waves of tone flood the room, and the murmur of the wind gives way to a terrible roaring frenzy of sound. The nigh penniless dauber who heard that terrible roaring frenzy was, of course, Adolf Hitler. Regardless of the audience, private theatre is self-evident within the musical and textual dislocation experienced in the second act of Tristan and Isolde, which becomes a hallucinatory absence from which the lovers are finally shaken by the arrival of King Mark, Isolde's husband. Positive or negative, such private theatres became established tropes for post-Wagnerian operas, as indeed did the musical language that Wagner had created for them. Perhaps the strongest indicator of the enduring power of the hysterical and a Wagnerian aesthetic within opera in Vienna at the turn of the last century is to be found in composer Franz Schrecker's first opera, Der Ferne Klang. The opera, begun around 1904 but finally completed and staged 8 years later, is a private theatre narrative writ large. Der Ferne Klang is concerned with the composer Fritz's quest to find the eponymous distant sound that haunts his thoughts. The hunt leads him to rediscover his lost love Greta as a prostitute in Venice, only for him to reject her. And 5 years later, Greta hears that Fritz has been lampooned for his latest work, actually played out, sort of rather meta-theatrically, mythically even, offstage as passages of Der Ferne Klang, the very opera you are hearing. And she goes to console him. Her compassion makes him realise that the distant sound he had heard was love itself. As in Wagner's operas, this Klang is removed from tonal roots. It is, in effect, an elastic music, pulling us away from the normality and from normality into a sound world where split harmonies echo Breuer's splitting of consciousness. Musically, the idea of the double conscience provides a fitting portrayal of the sonically beautiful in Schrecker's work. It is the psychological basis of his fascination with Raumwirkung, melding the effects of timbre and the performing space. Furthermore, the pervasive polytonality of the composer's prevalent Klang self-referenced in the opera within an opera, echoes the polyconsciousness cited within neurasthenic practice at the time. Only when Greta reappears at the end of Der Ferne Klang and Fritz is pulled out of his private theatre does the tonal centre of the work return. Throughout the opera, Fritz turns to art for his answers, becoming in effect a sort of in loco creator of Schrecker's own private theatre. But in Der Ferne Klang, the disruption of the psychological space away from reality is not a point of disturbance, but of cure for Fritz. Writing his opera, which Schrecker then reenacts self-referentially as Der Ferne Klang within Der Ferne Klang in the third act, provides its own catharsis. But however much the terminology and analysis of Schrecker's first opera lends itself to Freudian readings, more germane to the actual terms of Breuer's findings in relation to Anna O is the plot and score of Schrecker's later opera, Die Gezeichneten, in which the composer extends the idea of a polytonal, multi-centred klang, or sound, into an ever-evolving harmonic canvas, constantly vacillating between tonal centres to indicate a much more irrevocable pathology. Even the creation of its libretto, Schrecker, like Wagner, wrote both text and music, seems to have been cause for a kind of psychological disruption. Schrecker's libretto for his Branded Wands had been hanging over him since he started writing it in 1911, when fellow composer Alexander Zemlinsky commissioned it as the tragedy of the ugly man. Zemlinsky was far from handsome. Alma Mahler cruelly described her former lover as the ugliest man in Vienna. So there was, as in Schrecker's Der Ferne Klang, perhaps a note of biography in his request. Schrecker dutifully set to work, but, as he wrote, he realised there was a fundamental problem. The more I worked on it, the more abhorrent, the more unbearable I found the thought that not I, but another would compose the music to it. Music that was already taking firm shape and form within me. And it seemed to me as if, along with a libretto, I was giving Zemlinsky my musical self, as if I was selling my innermost soul, my very life. And I decided I would fight for the libretto. No fight was necessary, however, as Zemlinsky abandoned that project and found his inspiration instead in Oscar Wilde's Birthday of the Infanta. But Schrecker's melodramatic statements provide a strong parallel with the problem that besets his protagonist Alviano in the opera. That of misuse of an artist's creation, or if you will, the pollution of his private theatre. The hunchback Alviano has built Elysium, an island paradise off Genoa's coastline. Unable to deal with his manifestly ugly present, Alviano has created a quasi-mythological realm where all must pay homage to beauty. The nobles in Genoa have been using the island, however, for orgies. Act 3 takes place during one such party, as the citizens walk dumbfounded around Alviano's glorious creation, creating a real problem for stage designers. Tomorrow, one of the nobles has lured Alviano's betrothed Carlotta to the island. Alviano discovers them, with Carlotta nigh lifeless in the middle of the grotto. Alviano stabs Tomorrow and runs to Carlotta's side, but rather than calling out for him, she calls out for Tomorrow. This moment triggers a desperate response from Alviano. He turns from singing to speech, and the walls of his private theatre come tumbling down. This is a moment in which we discern a musical parallel to the hysteria shown by Bette Pappenheim. Reveries and reflections during a more or less mechanical occupation, we are told, do not in themselves imply a pathological splitting of consciousness. Breuer goes on to say that if they are interrupted, the normal unity of consciousness should be restored. But in the case of Anna O and Alviano in Schrecker's opera Die Gezeichneten, this habit, the constant escape into a private theatre, an Elysium, a realm beyond reality, outside the city walls, beyond customary tonality, prepared the ground upon which the effect of anxiety and dread was able to establish itself, transforming the patient's or Alviano's habitual daydreaming into a hallucinatory absence. If we look at the background to Alviano's case as such in Die Gezeichneten, the parallels with the Anna O account are surprising. Like Anna, Alviano is cut off from his peers. where Anna led an extremely monotonous existence in her puritanically minded family and escaped into the private theatre of her thoughts, Alviano, the ugly man within a beautiful world, escapes into the creation of his Elysium. It is precisely the behaviour of Gaston Leroux's Phantom of the Opera from his novel of 1906, who was seen as a pariah, but is in fact a creative genius, who is responsible for the building of the Hall of Mirrors in the Palace of the Shah of Persia, and of course the Opera Garnier in Paris, the ultimate private theatre made public. Schrecker was nonetheless very much aware of the psychological discourse of his time, and steeped himself in psychosexual theory. He was particularly drawn to the writing of Otto Weininger, himself immersed in Freudian thought. Citing these forces, Weininger in particular, Schrecker confessed to his critic confidant Paul Becker about the type of operas or operatic narratives he wanted to create. "I've always wanted to write something quite different, indeed fundamentally different. I simply cannot free myself from the thought, just as you write, that the relationship between man and woman and everything that's associated with this relationship is fundamentally tragic, even in the happiest instances. And this tragedy must be written and be entitled The Blissful Ones. It's mere self-deluded morphianism. Happiness is not to be found on this planet, or indeed on any other. The stupor of intoxication, a stumbling towards light, and a sudden incineration. Well, the fate of certain animals who live in a natural relationship with the plant world around them says more to me than the fate of humans, who simply delude themselves with the idea of being special and aware. Please don't get me wrong. I'm not presumptuous enough to believe that what I write is absolute truth. Ultimately, in the end, everything is subjective. But I believe that artists and poets somehow manage to get slightly closer to these elusive truths than others. A shade of Schopenhauer there, too. The tragedy, predicated on the gap between what is known and the search for these elusive truths, is the essence of Schrecker's struggle, Wagner's too. But most importantly, that of the characters Schrecker chooses to present within his operas. In short, regardless of their time or situation, whether early 20th century composer in Der Ferne Klang, or 16th century humpback in Die Gesegneten, or even in the medieval Never-Neverland of Wagner's own pluralized mythology, these characters are ripe for psychoanalytic investigation. Each of them tells the story of striving for a reality, finding themselves addled, trapped in a private theatre, sometimes of their own making, ready for it not to be knocked down. But if Schrecker teases at the edges of the parallels between opera and Breuer and Freud's studies, Erich Wolfgang Korngold flaunts them in his 1920 opera Die Tote Stadt. Unlike Schrecker, however, Korngold was more naturally conservative, a child prodigy whose father, the music critic Julius Korngold, who replaced Edward Hanslick on the Neue Freie Presse, kept his son under close guard. But while Korngold was outwardly less inclined to adopt cultural tropes than Franz Schrecker, his opera, based on Georges Rodenbach's 1892 novel Bruges la Morte, triggers extraordinary Breuerian and Freudian associations. The opera tells the story of Paul, who is obsessed with the memory of his dead wife, Marie. He keeps a room dedicated to her memory, with a portrait, her hair in a glass case, and various other trinkets and tributes. Paul has, however, met a new woman, whom he thinks is the resurrected figure of his dead, mythologized wife. She is called Marietta, and as she realizes when she sees Marie's portrait, looks just like her. What ensues is a nightmare sequence in which Marietta vows to exorcise the ghost of her predecessor. At the height of the dream, Paul murders Marietta with Marie's treasured hair, and exhales, "Jetzt gleich sie ihr ganz, Marie." Now you are just like the other Marie. Was Paul's intense grief actually the result of murder? Or has his plan always been to create the perfect memorial to his wife, in the form of another dead woman who looks just like her? As in Schrecker's Die Gesegneten, Paul's realm, dedicated to Marie, appears like a physical manifestation of the private theatre. Within this space, fantastical things can happen, triggered by Paul's great poetic and imaginative gift, and the sad but very charming tales he tells. More often than not, Paul moves away from the charming, evident in the famous aria Glück, das mir verblieb, to something more dispiriting. His habit of daydreaming has evidently become a full dissociation of his mental personality. Unlike the bounds of normality discussed by Breuer, Paul is seemingly unable to recognise the difference between reality and unreality. His private theatre has in effect become all-encompassing, a self-abasing myth, and for Kongold is the basis of his opera. Of course, many may be wondering whether this is all coincidental. After all, wasn't Georges Rodenbach's novel written about Bruges before Freud had really hit the cultural consciousness of his time? A rejoinder to that is to be found in the highly adapted form in which Rodenbach's novel is presented on the operatic stage. Rather than the atmospheric, if maudlin, tale offered in the original, Kongold and his father tapped something of the spirit of their own city of Vienna, showing remarkably strong psychological credentials. Julius Kongold later remarked that the transformation of the action into a dream was my idea. I suggested it to soften the impact of the strangling of a woman to create a conciliatory, elegiac ending. But far from softening the tale, the dream, enacted through a two-act hallucinatory absence in the opera, increases its impact and distances the story further and further from the reality to which Paul must return if he is to be cured of his neurasthenia under which he has been suffering due to his grief. Here the parallels with Anna O go even further, for both figures are suffering from intense grief, triggering deep descents into their respective private theatres. In the German director Willy Decker's 2004 production of Die Tote Stadt for the Salzburg Festival, subsequently staged in Vienna, Amsterdam, Barcelona, Paris, San Francisco, Madrid, Bilbao and the Royal Opera House, the idea of a private theatre of grief in which the effect of anxiety and dread was able to establish itself and transform the patient's habitual daydreaming into a hallucinatory absence became the central tenet of the production. Rather than a dream narrative, Decker and his designer Wolfgang Gussmann actually placed a secondary space on the stage, which mirrored the characters and actions within Paul's shrine to Marie. Marietta was, in effect, another manifestation, an imago of his grief, just as his friend Fritz, one of the few people allowed to step over the threshold into what Paul describes as the temple of the past, becomes the serenade-singing Pierrot in Act Two. This parallelism is not entirely encouraged by Kongold originally, who only included the doubling of Marie, a Marietta, in his score, yet it entirely makes sense within the context of a private theatre and the figures that interrupt it. Decker explained that the dead city is a realm of the soul, a deep, darkened space where the mourners lead an appearance of existence with the shadows of their dead. This space can be found wherever vibrant sorrow has changed into a petrified state of despair, where pain has crossed over into a negation of life. In order for us to see this realm of the soul in action, I thought I'd show you a brief passage from the end of Act One of Willy Decker's production. Here we see here the meeting of Paul's own myth about Marie, the post-Wagnerian sound world, and all the psychological clout of Breuer and Freud's Vienna. Freud and Wagner provide the access to myth that Paul so craves. I'm afraid that there aren't actually subtitles on this video. It's an archive recording, perfectly legal. I'm just going to give you an idea of the text that is being sung. I'm sure all of you are fluent German speakers, but I just thought I'd give you a little bit so you get the mood of what's being sung. Marie is crying out the word Paul, and Paul responds, "Ah, Marie, you are here. I knew it. Are you quite sure that you are true to me?" she says. "I am true to you. You've never vanished from this room. Ah, that is why I never took my hair with me when I was torn away, but left the golden tresses that you love. I know, I know. My hair will never die," she says, "but will keep watch where our love was, is, and will be. You're always with me," he says, "always and forever, with me in this deserted town. I hear you in its chimes, I see you in its waters. And yet you will forget her who does not live and breathe beside you? That other one, 'tis you I see in her." The allure of Marie is clear here in the opera, and you can hear her presence through long, longing lines and the mellifluous beauty of her lute song. Marietta mimics that, of course, but she is more readily associated with the trish-trash, discordant idiom. Which one is real is for us ultimately to decide. It is left ambiguous. Paul kills Marietta in the dream, the world in which she operates most fully, but then, quite by surprise, she walks back into the room to collect her umbrella. Korngold creates a suitably divisive musical language based in post-Wagnerian dialectics in which reality and unreality are constantly musically blurred. Paul escapes the real dystopia of a world of grief only to discover that his private theatre is, like his reality, equally divided. Only catharsis and cure can rescue Paul from this pervasive dissociation of his mental personality caused by the debilitating effects of grief. In the private theatre of his temple of the past, he enacts, or reenacts, the death of Marie. This is, in effect, the catharsis that Breuer had noted transformed Anna O's behaviour. Breuer and Freud remarked that if Anna could recall the moment at which a particular hysterical symptom appeared, and she could re-experience the emotion accompanying that event, then the symptom would be cured. For both Anna and Paul, that emotion is grief. Anna's catharsis was triggered by hypnosis, while Paul's is created through the not-so-private theatre of the operatic stage and its own dissociation between the dream and myth he wants to create and the nightmare that unfolds. He kills Marietta to be released from the death of Marie, which he may or may not have caused in the first place. In the final movements of Billy Decker's production of Die Tote Stadt, the director offers an amazing visual metaphor for the release that the De Breuer-type catharsis engenders. The door to the private theatre, which we saw Paul closing there, is left open. Paul's friend, Frank or Fritz, who enters just as the still-alive Marietta leaves, asks Paul a question. As if having sat there like Breuer or Freud during a talking cure or hypnosis session, Frank calls the analysis to an end. I have to leave again. Paul, will you come and leave this city of death? Frank is in effect asking whether Paul can leave behind his private theatre. The resolution here is not so brutal as in Der Ferne Klang, where Fritz is jolted out of his split consciousness only to die, or indeed Gesichneten, where Alviano witnesses the destruction of his dreams. Here, Korngold truly offers cure. The door is left open as Frank goes on his way. The strains of Marie's old song sound once more, now offering benediction, catharsis, and the restoration of the tonal centre from which Paul's private theatre has wandered. There is, he says, no second life down here. In time, these operas I have spoken about, unlike Wagner's, would themselves become their own form of private theatre, if we extend the metaphor yet further. Like Freud, who fled from the Nazis to London in 1938, the creators of these highly textured psychological music dramas were the subject of censure and prescription. Removed from opera houses, unplayed by orchestras, and dismissed from their posts, the composers of these manifestations of a post-Wagnerian cum Freudian aesthetic were rendered obsolete. This was not only a major tragedy in itself, but it severed our discussion of psychological ideas within opera that other cultures, those outside Vienna and the domain of Breuer and Freud, were just not part and parcel of. Schrecker died in 1933, shortly after being dismissed from his post in Berlin. Korngold was exiled to Hollywood, where his post-Wagnerian musical style provided the oral envelope for the private theatre of the new art of film, in which music positively encourages us to engage in habitual daydreaming, papering over narrative cracks, silencing our critical and disbelieving faculties, allowing us again to create yet more myths. Thank you very much.
Straight away and open the floor to the discussion. a single note of the expert that was being played. And a rather caddish man on the front row said, "Very private theatre." So please don't damn me with silence again.
Can you say your name, please, and what you do?
My name is Catherine O'Leary, and I have the pleasure of bumping into Gavin on the train coming here. But and I just want to say that was an amazing talk. But what I absolutely appreciated is the way you speak musically and about psychology at the same time. And I'll give one example. Outside the city walls and beyond tonality. Putting the two of them together is, it's extraordinary. This constant referring to music and using the music. I can't even describe what I'm trying to say, but I loved that. Thank you.
Well, thank you. It's very kind. I think the idea, I'll take what Anthony said earlier about there are people among us who aren't musicologists, musical sort of spot keys and the like. But I hope, even if you don't necessarily have the jargon or all the interpretive kind of tools to understand this element within Wagner, and particularly from Tristan onwards, is that that is Wagner's greatest musical achievement, is to liberate us from this kind of the confines of tonality. I mean, tonality is a wonderful thing. Anyone who listens to, you know, Beethoven, Mozart, and Haydn will, you know, the richness that this kind of this rule book, this scheme that was passed down to us can allow us to create is amazing. But also that tonality became freer at a point when the unconscious was tapped, at a point when Adolf Loos and Otto Wagner got rid of facades and meretricious decoration, you know, at a point when Schnitzler, you know, went into the roots of, you know, behaviour as well within his writing. I just find it extraordinary that when we have this kind of free associations of the Viennese Fin de Siècle particularly, that these composers gave us a musical language to echo that, which is rootless, which is free, and which, in the case of Tristan, takes 6 hours to return to the point from which it first went. I mean, I find that absolutely amazing that a man can conceive of a tonal shape that takes 6 hours to reach B major. That is an extraordinary thing. And even if you don't know that it's B major at the end of it, you will feel the effects of that. Because we all crave the simplicity of a pop song, whatever that pop song might be. It might be, your favourite, your nursery rhymes, or, you know, God Save the Queen, or whatever it might be. But Wagner denies us that. He makes us yearn for what Tristan and Isolde yearn, and Schrecker and Korngold align us with the subject too, which I think is an amazing achievement.
Jonathan Glazius retired. Why don't we have more of Korngold? I saw that production of Mozart at Covent Garden and thought it was absolutely fantastic. And there are many other operas written. He was considered a child prodigy by Mahler and Strauss. And I can't understand why he's not more in the mainstream. Is this to do with his move to Hollywood, where people look down their noses at what he did there?
Well, Korngold has the problem of being popular, and that's the things that we first heard of him. But there's a twofold problem. The first one is that the prescription of Jewish music in the 1930s by the Nazis severed basically the greatest cultural arm of Austro-German musical identity. If we think of the figures who came after Wagner, you know, 75% of them were Jews. And of those, well, half of them had gone down the route of serialism, and the other half had maintained this polytonal kind of post-romantic idiom. And they just severed it. And after the war came Stockhausen and the Darmstadt experiments, where they just didn't want to be reminded of that. Wolfgang Holzmeier, the baritone, said recently about, you know, Das Knaben Wunderhorn, there isn't a setting of Das Knaben Wunderhorn by any composer after the 30s of note. I'm sure lots of people have written settings, but none that he was recording in this complete survey of the Wunderhorn leader, because he said after the war we didn't want to be reminded of those times. And the denial of this kind of simplicity, where actually cure and the cure of a very beautiful tune could be offered. And that's a problem. And the second problem is that Korngold was associated with, you know, Errol Flynn for the rest of his life. That's a real issue. I mean, in the very, very unlikely event that Andrew Lloyd Webber writes a masterpiece, it will be very hard for him to kind of trump the other not so Meisterwerke works that he's offered us. And that's not to compare Korngold's film scores with Lloyd Webber's musicals at all. But he is associated with that, and I think it's hard to shrug off popularity. And we are snobs when it comes to classical music, and that's a great error.
Thank you. His colleague here,
John Martin, a professor of cardiology at University College London, and professional academic bond scorer.
Brace ourselves.
I think what you were saying was that musical splitting is an analogy for psychological splitting. And I found that very convincing what you said. But in my world, the big split is between neuroscience and psychology, or Freud's. And my neuroscientist colleagues are telling me all the time, there is no soul. All of Freud and Wagner are simply electrical changes. Whereas I would like to believe that there is a higher function integrating that, which can do the sort of splitting you're talking about. And I found the way that you described it convincing that there must be a soul. And I refuse to believe that the immense complexity of the psychological and physical world mingles. Comment on the big split in the future 50 years is going to be between molecular biology and psychology.
Well, I seriously hope. Thank you. I seriously hope that we sort of maintain. I've just had out a copy of Schopenhauer to every single neuroscientist then around the world, because if he's left us anything. And it breathes through Tristan and Isolde, is the idea that not everything can be connected with the phenomenal world. We cannot explain, you know, scientists may cling to phenomena, but and artists, I think, cling to the noumenal world. And as Kant and Schopenhauer showed us, and as Wagner shows us, and all these composers that came after him, you can't have one without the other. And you know, the equipment we're given, which is scientific, or can be interpreted through science, only really has validity because of the thing that we cannot explain about it. That's fine. It is synapses, electrical charges, whatever. Certainly stuff that I don't necessarily feel comfortable with. I gave up science at GCSE as soon as I could. But it's only valid if that has an impact on us. And I think that is what has driven you all here today as well. That's because otherwise we'd be sort of rendered automatons by it. I think embrace the noumenal world would be my... Because that is more real, certainly to me, and it certainly was to Wagner, than the phenomenal world.
My name's Peter Tucker. I'm a clinical psychologist. I work with kids with brain injury, and I have an interest in neuropsychology and love of Wagner, but a real problem with it, as we mentioned before. My comment on that is that these issues are different explanations of the same phenomena. So one can talk about a molecular description going on in the activity of the brain, but also the same experience can be described psychologically. My point I wanted to put was two thoughts really about your private world, private theatre idea. In one way I agree with you, in another I disagree with you. So, for example, if people went to the Ring Cycle at the Proms this year, there were 15 whole seconds of silence after the end of Goethe Dämmerung, which could be interpreted as a corporate unwillingness to come out of the theatre, I think. But also, the other side of it is there's a psychologist from Russia, Vygotsky, whose idea was that mind isn't just in heads, it's between people, it's in society, it's a very simple Marxist history. And in a sense, that isn't very private.
I agree. I don't disagree with the idea of a kind of corporate thought, a sharing. I mean, that is what applause is in a way. We don't applaud a CD at home. It's very interesting though that going back to the details I gave about, you know, Wagner's theatrical aesthetic with the dimming of the lights, the forcing of the orchestra out of sight. This idea that, you know, music sort of emerges within the darkness at Bayreuth, something that Mahler adopted wholesale at the Hofburg in Vienna and actually lowered the pit there to mimic Bayreuth, I think is directly intended for us not to feel it on a corporate, in a corporate way. It is for us to experience it in a solitary, the whole darkness is that we shouldn't really be aware that our wife, girlfriend, boyfriend is sitting next to us and bought the ticket. It's to silence that, or to dumb that, as it were, in order for other senses to be triggered further. It's quite hard sometimes when, you know, latecomers are permitted or whatever, something else that Mahler banned, but, I think that is about that experience.
Thank you. I think, John,
John Lawrence. I don't know if this is a phenomenon of private theatre, but I noticed by concerts or performances, it's particularly true after the Baron-Quine Ring that Chaplin mentioned, that I couldn't get out of my mind for days and days and days. And I didn't know whether I couldn't or I didn't want to, but it stayed constantly. It was night and day, which was extraordinary. And I finally cured myself of it by going to visit Beethoven, which seemed to sort of not drive it away, but kind of clean it away somehow. And I noticed when I first ever saw a performance in Parsifal, I went home and listened to the entire opera again, way into the night, because again I couldn't leave it. Now, is that trapped into a private theatre? But I don't know
that
music does anything like that to me.
Apart from Wagner's. Yeah. Well, wonderful that you had that experience, and certainly I've had that experience after Wagner. I have it every time after Mahler. But yes. No. I mean, I think there is an alignment as well that we are meant to experience, and that's going back to that feeling is that we are meant to be surrounded by this, the kind of idea of an oral envelope or whatever, is that we are aligned to the work that we're hearing, seeing in these operas, which I think is an effect of the way that the music has changed in it.
Look, I think we must stop for coffee. Have we time for just one?
Oh, it's really not important. I was just thinking, Joyce Glasser. I was just thinking about his comment that maybe it's like waking up from a dream, and you want to go back to sleep to finish the dream or to prolong it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, look. Let's have a molecular moment and go and have coffee. Thank you very much to Gavin Plumley. Thank you very much.